problems, are they?
No, Max said, laughing. Evelyn, you could be 97 years old, and the whole world would line up to see your chest.
Then what are you talking about?
Don, he said.
Don who?
Your part, he said. The whole movie, all of it.
What?
You're playing opposite Don Adler.
Why did you agree to do it? I asked her. Why not say you wanted him cut from the film?
Well, first of all, you don't go throwing your weight around unless you're sure you'll win, Evelyn says. And I was only about 80% sure that if I pitched a fit, Max would fire him. And second of all, it seemed mildly cruel, to be honest. Don was not doing well. He hadn't had a hit in years, and most younger moviegoers didn't know who he was. He was divorced from Ruby, hadn't remarried, and the rumor was that his drinking had gotten out of control. So you felt bad for him? Your abuser? Relationships are complex, Evelyn says. People are messy, and love can be ugly. I'm inclined to always err on the side of compassion. You're saying you had compassion for what he was going through? I'm saying you should have a little compassion for how complicated it must have been for me. Cut down to size. I find myself staring at the floor, unable to look at her. I'm sorry, I say. I haven't been in that situation before, and I don't know what I was thinking, making any sort of judgment. I apologize. Evelyn smiles gently, accepting my apology. I can't speak for all people who have been hit by someone they love. But what I can tell you is that forgiveness is different from absolution. Don was no longer a threat to me. I was not scared of him. I felt powerful and free. So I told Max I'd meet with him. Celia was supportive, but also hesitant once she learned Don had been cast. Harry, while cautious, trusted my ability to handle the situation. So my representatives called Don's people, and we set a time and place for the next time I was in L.A. I had suggested the bar at the Beverly Hills Hotel, but Don's team changed it at the last minute to Cantor's Deli. That's how I ended up seeing my ex-husband for the first time in more than 15 years, over a pair of Rubens.
I'm sorry, Evelyn, Don said when he sat down. I had already ordered an iced tea and eaten half of a sour pickle. I thought he was apologizing for being late.
It's only 1:05, I said. It's fine.
No, he said, shaking his head. He looked pale, but also a bit thinner than some of his recent photos. The years we had been apart had not been good to Don. His face had bloated, and his waistline had widened. But he was still heads and tails more handsome than anyone else in the place. Don was the sort of man who was always going to be handsome, no matter what happened to him. His good looks were just that loyal. I'm sorry, he said. The emphasis, the meaningfulness of it hit me. It caught me off guard. The waitress came by and asked for his drink order. He didn't order a martini or a beer. He ordered a Coca-Cola. When she left, I found myself unsure what to say to him. I'm sober, he said. Have been for 256 days.
That many, huh? I said as I took a sip of my iced tea.
I was a drunk, Evelyn. I know that now.
You were also a cheater and a pig, I said.
Don nodded. I know that, too.
And I'm deeply sorry.
I had flown all the way here to see if I could do a movie with him. I had not come to be apologized to. The thought had never occurred to me. I merely assumed I would use him this time the way I used him back then. His name, near mine, would get people talking. But this repentant man in front of me was surprising and overwhelming.
What am I supposed to do with that? I asked him. That you're sorry. What is that supposed to mean to me?
The waitress came and took our orders. "A Reuben, please," I said, handing her the menu. If I was going to have a real conversation about this, I needed a hearty meal. "I'll have the same," Don said. She knew who we were. I could see it in the way her lips kept trying to hold back a smile. When she left, Don leaned in. "I know it doesn't make up for what I did to you," he said. "Good," I said, "because it really doesn't." "But I hope it might make you feel a little better," he said, "to know that I know I was wrong. I know you deserved better, and I'm working every day to be a better man." "Well, it's awfully late now," I said. "You being a better man does nothing for me." "I won't hurt anyone like I did then," Don said. "To you, to Ruby." My heart of ice melted briefly, and I admitted that did make me feel better. "Still," I said, "we all can't go around treating people like dog shit and then expecting that a simple, I'm sorry, erases it." Don shook his head humbly. "Of course not," he said. "No, I know that. And if your movies hadn't tanked, and Ari Sullivan hadn't dropped you like you got him to drop me, you'd probably still be living high on the hog, drunk as a skunk." Don nodded. "Probably. I'm sorry to say you are most likely right about that." I wanted more. Did I want him to grovel, to cry? I wasn't sure. I just knew I wasn't getting it. "Let me just say this," Don said. "I loved you from the moment I saw you. I loved you madly. And I ruined it because I turned into a man I'm not proud of. And because I ruined it the way I did, because I was awful at treating you the way you deserved to be treated, I am sorry. Sometimes I think about going back to our wedding day and wanting to do it all over again, wanting to fix my mistakes so that you never have to go through what I put you through. I know I can't do that, but what I can do is look you in the eye and tell you from the very bottom of my heart that I know how incredible you are. I know how great we could have been together. I know that everything we both lost was my fault. I am dedicated to never behaving that poorly again, and I am truly, truly sorry." In all my years after Don, all my movies, all my marriages, I had never once wanted to go back in time in the hopes that Don and I could get it right. My life since Don had been a story of my own making, a mess and a joy of my own decisions, and a string of experiences that landed me with everything I ever wanted. I was okay. I felt safe. I had a beautiful daughter, a devoted husband, and the love of a good woman. I had money and fame. I had a gorgeous house in a city I had reclaimed. What could Don Adler take from me? If I had come to see if I could stand him, I found that I could. There was not a bone in my body that was afraid of him. And then I realized, if that was true, what did I have to lose? I did not say the words, "I forgive you," to Don Adler. I simply took my wallet out of my purse and said, "Do you want to see a picture of Connor?" He smiled and nodded, and when I showed him her photo, he laughed. "She looks just like you," he said. "I'll take that as a compliment." "I don't think there's any other way to take it. I think every woman in this country would like to look like Evelyn Hugo." I threw my head back and laughed. When our Reubens were half-eaten and taken away by the waitress, I told him I'd do the movie. "That's great," he said. "Really great to hear. I think you and I could really... I think we can really give them a show." "We're not friends, Don," I said. "I want to be clear on that." Don nodded. "Okay," he said. "I understand. But I think we can be friendly." Don smiled. "I'd be honored by friendly." Just before shooting was set to commence, Harry turned 45. He said he didn't want a big night out or any sort of formal plans. He just wanted a nice day with all of us. So John, Celia, and I planned a picnic in the park. Luisa packed us lunch, Celia made sangria, John went down to the sporting goods store and got us an extra-large umbrella to shade us from not only the sun but also passers-by. On the way home, he got the bright idea to buy us wigs and sunglasses, too. That afternoon, the three of us told Harry we had a surprise for him, and we led him into the park, Connor riding on his back. She loved to be strapped to him. She would laugh as he bounced her while he walked. I took his hand and dragged him with us. "Where are we going?" he said. "Someone at least give me a hint." "I'll give you a small one," Celia said, as we were crossing Fifth Avenue. "No," John said, shaking his head. "No hints. He's too good with hints. It takes all the fun out of it." "Connor, where's everyone taking Daddy?" Harry said. I watched as Connor laughed at the sound of her name. When Celia walked through the entrance to the park, not even a block from our apartment, Harry spotted the blanket already set out with the umbrella and the picnic baskets, and he smiled. "A picnic?" he said. "Simple family picnic, just the five of us," I said. Harry smiled. He closed his eyes for a moment, as if he'd reached heaven. "Absolutely perfect," he said. "I made the sangria," Celia said. "Luisa made the food, obviously." "Obviously," Harry said, laughing. "And John got the umbrella." John bent down and grabbed the wigs. "And these." He handed me a curly black one and gave Celia a short blonde one. Harry took a red one, and John put on the long brown one that made him look like a hippie. We all laughed as we looked at one another, but I was surprised to see just how realistic they managed to be. And when I put on the coordinating pair of sunglasses, I felt a little freer. "If you got the wigs and Celia made the sangria, what did Evelyn do?" Harry asked as he took Connor off his back and put her on the blanket. I grabbed her and helped her sit up. "Good question," John said, smiling. "You'd have to ask her." "Oh, I helped," I said. "Actually, yeah, Evelyn, what did you do?" Celia said. I looked up to see the three of them all staring at me teasingly. I gestured vaguely to the picnic basket. "You know." "No," Harry said, laughing. "I don't know." "Listen, I've been very busy," I said. "Uh-huh," Celia said. "Oh, all right." I lifted Connor up as she started to frown. I knew it meant tears were coming any moment. "I didn't do a damn thing." The three of them started laughing at me, and then Connor started laughing, too. John opened the basket, Celia poured wine, Harry leaned over and kissed Connor's forehead. It was one of the last times we were all together, laughing, smiling, happy, a family. Because after that, I ruined it. Don and I were in the middle of shooting 3 a.m. in New York. Luisa, Celia, and Harry were trading off watching Connor while I was at work. The days were longer than we anticipated, and the shoot ran long. I played Patricia, a woman in love with a drug addict, Mark, played by Don. And every day I could see that he was not the old Don I knew, showing up to set and saying some lines with charm. This was striking, superlative, raw acting. He was pulling from his life, and he was putting it on film. On set, you really hope that it's all coming together into something magical in the camera lens, but there's never any way to know for sure. Even when Harry and I were producing work ourselves, when we were watching the dailies so often that my eyes felt dry and I was losing track of reality versus film, we were never 100% sure that all the parts were coming together perfectly until we saw the first cut. But on the set of 3 a.m., I just knew. I knew it was a movie that would change how people saw me, how people saw Don. I thought it might just be good enough to change lives, to get people clean. It might just be good enough to change the way movies were made. So I sacrificed. When Max wanted more days, I gave up time with Connor to be there. When Max wanted more nights, I gave up dinners and evenings with Celia. I must have called Celia almost every day from the set, apologizing for something. Apologizing that I couldn't meet her at the restaurant in time. Apologizing that I needed her to stay home and watch Connor for me. I could tell that part of her regretted pushing me to do the movie. I don't think she liked me working with my ex-husband every day. I don't think she liked me working with Max Gerard every day. I don't think she liked my long hours. And I got the impression that while she loved my baby girl, babysitting wasn't exactly her idea of a good time. But she kept it to herself and supported me. When I called to say I'd be late for the millionth time, she would say, "It's okay, honey. Don't worry. Just be great." She was an excellent partner in that regard, putting me first, putting my work first. And then, toward the end of shooting, after a long day of emotional scene work, I was in my dressing room getting ready to go home when Max knocked on my door. "Hey," I said, "what's on your mind?" He looked at me with consideration and then took a seat. I remained standing, committed to leaving. "I think, Evelyn, we have something to think about."
"We do?"
"The love scene is next week."
"I'm aware."
"This movie, it is almost done."
"Yes."
"And I think it is missing something."
"Like what?"
"I think that the viewer needs to understand the raw magnetism of Patricia and Mark's attraction."
"I agree. That's why I agreed to really show my breasts."
"You're getting what no other filmmaker, including yourself, has ever gotten from me before. I'd think you'd be thrilled."
"Yes, of course I am, but I think we need to show that Patricia is a woman who takes what she wants, who delights in the sins of the flesh. She is right now such a martyr. She's a saint, helping Mark all through the film, standing by him."
"Right, because of how much she loves him."
"Yes, but we also need to see why she loves him. What does he give to her? What does she get from him?"
"What are you getting at?"
"I want us to shoot something almost no one does, which is, I want to show you screwing because you love it."
His eyes were wide and excited. He was creatively enthralled. I always knew Max was a little lascivious, but this was different. This was a rebellious act.
"Think about it. Sex scenes are about love or power."
"Sure. And the purpose of the love scene next week is to show how much Patricia loves Mark, how much she believes in him, how strong their connection is."
Max shakes his head. "I wanted to show the audience that part of the reason Patricia loves Mark is because he makes her orgasm."
I felt myself pulling back, trying to take it all in. It shouldn't have felt so scandalous. And yet it absolutely was. Women have sex for intimacy. Men have sex for pleasure. That's what culture tells us. The idea that I'd be shown to enjoy my body, to desire the male form just as strongly as I was desired, to show a woman putting her own physical pleasure at the forefront, it felt daring. What Max was talking about was a graphic portrayal a female desire, and my gut instinct was that I loved the idea. I mean, the thought of filming a graphic sex scene with Don was about as arousing to me as a bowl of bran flakes, but I wanted to push the envelope. I wanted to show a woman getting off. I liked the idea of showing a woman having sex because she wanted to be pleased instead of being desperate to please. So, in a moment of excitement, I grabbed my coat, put out my hand, and said, "I'm in." Max laughed and hopped out of his chair, taking my hand and shaking it. "Fantastique, ma belle!" What I should have done was tell him I had to think about it.
What I should have done was tell Celia about it the moment I got home. What I should have done was give her a say. I should have given her the opportunity to express any misgivings. I should have respected that while she had no place to tell me what I could and could not do with my body, I did have a responsibility to inquire about how my actions might affect her. I should have taken her out to dinner and told her what I wanted to do and explained why I wanted to do it. I should have made love to her that night to show her that the only body I was truly interested in deriving pleasure from was hers. These are simply things you do. These are kindnesses you extend to the person you love when you know that your job will entail the world seeing images of you having sex with another person. I did none of that for Celia. Instead, I avoided her. I went home and checked on Connor. I went into the kitchen and ate a chicken salad Luisa had left in the fridge. Celia came in and hugged me. How was shooting? Good, I said, completely fine. And because she didn't say, how was your day, or anything interesting happened with Max, or even, how's next week looking, I didn't bring it up. I had two shots of bourbon before Max yelled, action! The set was closed. Just me, Don, Max, the cinematographer, and a couple of guys working lighting and sound. I closed my eyes and told myself to remember how good it felt to want Don all those years ago. I thought of how sublime it was to awaken my own desire, to realize I liked sex, that it wasn't just about what men wanted, that it was about me too. I thought of how I wanted to put that seed of a thought into other women's brains. I thought of how there might be other women out there scared of their own pleasure, of their own power. I thought of what it would mean to have just one woman go home to her husband and say, give me what he gave her. I put myself in that place of desperate wanting, the ache of needing something only someone else can give you. I used to have that with Don. I had it then with Celia. So I closed my eyes, I focused in on myself, and I went there. Later on, people would say that Don and I were really having sex in the movie. There were all sorts of rumors that the sex was unsimulated, but those rumors were complete and utter bullshit. People just thought they saw real sex because the energy was searing. Because I convinced myself in that moment that I was a woman in urgent need of him. Because Don was able to remember how it felt to want me before he ever had me. That day on set, I truly let go. I was present and wild and unrestrained, more than I ever had been on film before, more than I ever have been since. It was a moment of purely imagined, reckless euphoria. When Max yelled cut, I snapped out of it. I stood up and rushed to my robe. I blushed. Me, Evelyn Hugo, blushing. Don asked if I was all right, and I turned away from him, not wanting him to touch me. I'm fine, I said, and then I went to my dressing room, closed the door, and bawled my eyes out. I wasn't ashamed of what I'd done. I wasn't nervous for audiences to see it. The tears that fell down my face were because I realized what I had done to Celia. I had been a person who believed she stuck by a certain code. It may not have been a code that others subscribed to, but it was one that made sense to me. And part of that code was being honest with Celia, being good to her. And this was not good to Celia. Doing what I had just done without her blessing was not good for the woman I loved. When we wrapped for the day, I walked the 50 blocks home instead of grabbing a car. I needed the time to myself. I stopped on the way and bought flowers. I called Harry from a payphone and asked him to take Connor for the night. Celia was in the bedroom when I got home, drying her hair.
I got you these, I said, handing her the bouquet of white lilies. I did not mention that the florist had said that white lilies mean, my love is pure. Oh, my God, she said, they are gorgeous, thank you. She smelled them and then grabbed a water glass, filled it from the tap, and put the flowers in it. Just for a moment, she said, until I have a chance to choose a vase. I wanted to ask you something, I said. Oh, boy, she said. Are these flowers just to butter me up? I shook my head. No, I said. The flowers are because I love you. Because I want you to know how often I think of you, how important you are to me. I don't tell you that enough. I wanted to tell you this way with those. Guilt is a feeling I've never made much peace with. I find that when it rears its head, it brings an army. When I feel guilty for one thing, I start to see all the other things I should feel guilty for. I sat on the foot of our bed. I wanted to let you know that Max and I have discussed it, and I think the love scene in the movie will be more graphic than you and I were thinking. How graphic? Something a bit more intense, something that conveys Patricia's desperate need to be pleasured. I was lying outright to hide a lie of omission. I was crafting a new narrative in which Celia would believe that I had asked for her blessing before doing what I had already done. Her need to be pleasured? We need to see what Patricia gets out of her relationship with Mark. It's not just love. It has to be more than that. That makes sense, Celia said. You're saying it answers the question, why does she stay with him? Yeah, I said, excited that maybe she would understand. Maybe I could fix this retroactively. Exactly. So we're going to shoot an explicit scene between Don and me. I'll be mostly nude. For the heart of the movie to really sink in, we need to see the two main characters truly vulnerable together, connecting sexually. Celia listened as I spoke, letting the words sink in. I could see her grappling with what I was saying, trying to make it fit for her. I want you to do the movie as you want to do it, she said. Thank you. She looked down and started shaking her head. I'm feeling very... I don't know. I'm not sure I can do this. Knowing you're with Don all day, with these long nights, and I never see you, and... Sex. Sex is sacred between us. I'm not sure I can stand to watch that. You won't need to watch it. But I'll know it happened. I'll know it's out there. And everyone will see it. I want to be okay with this. I really do. So be okay with it. I'm going to try. Thank you. I'm really going to try. Great. But Evelyn, I don't think I can. Just knowing that you were, when you slept with Mick, I was sick for years afterward, thinking about the two of you together. I know. And you slept with Harry, God knows how many times, she said. I know, honey, I know, but I'm not sleeping with Don. But you have slept with him, you have. When people watch the two of you on screen, they will be watching something the two of you have already done. It's not real, I said. I know, but what you're saying to me is that you are prepared to make it look real. You're saying you're going to make it look more real than anything else any of us have done so far. Yes, I said, I guess I am saying that. She started crying. She put her head in her hands. I feel like I'm failing you, she said, but I can't do it. I can't. I know myself, and I know this is too much for me. I'll be too sick over it. I'll make myself ill thinking of you with him. She shook her head, resolved. I'm sorry. I don't have it in me. I can't handle it. I want to be stronger for you. I do. I know that if the tables were turned, you could handle it. I feel like I'm disappointing you, and I'm so sorry, Evelyn. I will work forever to make it up to you. I'll help you get any part you want, for the rest of our lives. And I'll work on getting there so that the next time this happens, I can be stronger. But please, Evelyn,
I can't live through you sleeping with another man. Even if this time it only looks real, I can't do it. Please, she said, please don't do this. My heart sank. I nearly vomited. I looked down at the floor. I studied the way two planks of wood met just under my feet, how the nail heads were just the littlest bit sunken in. And then I looked up at her and said, I already did it. I sobbed, and I pleaded, and I groveled desperately on my knees, having long ago learned the lesson that you have to throw yourself at the mercy of the things you truly want. But before I was done, Celia said, all I've ever wanted was for you to be truly mine. But you've never been mine. Not really. I've always had to settle for one piece of you, while the world gets the other half. I don't blame you. It doesn't make me stop loving you. But I can't do it. I can't do it, Evelyn. I can't live with my heart half broken all the time. And she walked out the door and left me. Within a week, Celia had packed up all her things at my apartment and hers and moved back to L.A. She would not answer the phone when I called. I couldn't get hold of her. Then, weeks after she left, she filed for divorce from John. When he got the papers, I swear it was as if she had served them to me directly. It was clear, in no uncertain terms, that by divorcing him, she was divorcing me. I got John to make some calls to her agent, her manager. He tracked her down at the Beverly Wilshire. I flew to Los Angeles, and I pounded on her door. I was wearing my favorite, Diane von Furstenberg, because Celia had once said I was irresistible in it. There were a man and a woman coming out of their hotel room, and as they walked down the hall, they couldn't stop looking at me. They knew who I was, but I refused to hide. I just kept knocking on the door. When Celia finally opened it, I looked her in the eye and didn't say a word. She stared back at me, silent. And then, with tears in my eyes, I said simply, please. She turned away from me. I made a mistake, I said. I'll never do it again. The last time we had fought like this, I had refused to apologize. And I really thought that this time, if I just admitted how wrong I was, if I gave in sincerely and with all my heart, she would forgive me. But she didn't. I can't do it anymore, she said, as she shook her head. She was wearing high-waisted jeans and a Coca-Cola t-shirt. Her hair was long, past her shoulders. She was 37, but still looked like she was in her 20s. She always had a youthfulness to her that I never really had. I was 38 then, and I was starting to look it. When she said that, I got down on my knees in the hallway of the hotel and bawled my eyes out. She pulled me inside. Take me back, Celia, I begged her. Take me back, and I'll give the rest of it up. I'll give up everything but Connor. I won't ever act again. I'll let the world know about us. I'm ready to give you all of me, please. Celia listened, but then she very calmly sat down in the chair by the bed and said, Evelyn, you are not capable of giving it up, and you never will be. And it will be the tragedy of my life that I cannot love you enough to make you mine, that you cannot be loved enough to be anyone's. I stood there for a moment longer, waiting for her to say something else, but she didn't. She had nothing else to say, and there was nothing I could say that would change her mind. Facing reality, I got hold of myself, held in my tears, kissed her on her temple, and walked away. I got back on the plane to New York, hiding my pain, and it wasn't until I was back in my apartment that I lost it, sobbing as if she'd died. That's how final it felt. I had pushed her too far, and it was over.
That was truly it, I say.
She was done with me, Evelyn says.
What about the movie?
Are you asking if it was worth it? I guess so. The movie was a huge hit. Didn't make it worth it. Don Adler won an Oscar for it, didn't he? Evelyn rolls her eyes. That bastard won an Oscar, and I wasn't even nominated.
Why not? I've seen it,
I say. Parts of it, at least. You're great. Really exceptional. You think I don't know that?
Well, then, why weren't you nominated?
Because, Evelyn says, frustrated. Because I wasn't allowed to be applauded for it. It had an X rating. It was responsible for letters to the editor at nearly every paper in the country. It was too scandalous, too explicit. It got people excited. And when they felt that way, they had to blame someone, and they blamed me. What else were they going to do? Blame the French director? The French are like that, and they weren't going to blame the newly redeemed Don Adler. They blamed the sex pot they'd created, whom they could now call a tramp. They weren't going to give me an Oscar for that. They were going to watch it alone in a dark theater, and then chastise me in public. But it didn't hurt your career, I say. You did 2 more movies the next year. I made people money. No one turns away money. They were all too happy to get me in their movies and then talk about me behind my back. Within a few years, you delivered what is considered one of the most noble performances of the decade. Yeah, but I shouldn't have had to turn it around. I did nothing wrong. Well, we know that now. People were praising you and the film as early as the mid-80s. It's all fine in hindsight, Evelyn says. Except that I spent years with a scarlet A on my chest, while women and men across the country screwed each other's brains out thinking about what the movie meant. People were shocked by the representation of a woman wanting to get fucked. And while I'm aware of the crassness of my language, it's really the only way to describe it. Patricia was not a woman who wanted to make love. She wanted to get fucked, and we showed that. And people hated how much they loved it. She's still angry. I can see it in the way her jaw tightens. You won an Oscar shortly after that. I lost Celia for that movie, she says. My life, which I loved so much, was turned upside down over that movie. Of course, I understand it was my own fault. I'm the one who filmed an explicit sex scene with my ex-husband without talking to her about it first. I'm not trying to blame other people for the mistakes I made in my own relationship, but still. Evelyn is quiet, lost in her thoughts for a moment. I want to ask you something, because I think it's important for you to speak directly about it, I say. Okay. Did being bisexual put a strain on your relationship? I want to make sure to portray her sexuality with all of its nuance, in all of its complexity. What do you mean? She asks. There is a slight edge to her voice. You lost the woman you loved because of your sexual relationships with men. I think that's relevant to your larger identity. Evelyn listens to me and considers my words. Then she shakes her head. No. I lost the woman I loved because I cared about being famous as much as I cared about her. It had nothing to do with my sexuality. But you were using your sexuality to get things from men that Celia couldn't give you. Evelyn shakes her head even more emphatically. There's a difference between sexuality and sex. I used sex to get what I wanted. Sex is just an act. Sexuality is a sincere expression of desire and pleasure. That I always kept for Celia. I hadn't thought about it like that before, I say. Being bisexual didn't make me disloyal, Evelyn says. One has nothing to do with the other. Nor did it mean that Celia could only fulfill half my needs. I find myself interrupting her. I know you're not saying that, Evelyn says, but I want you to have it in my words. When Celia said she couldn't have all of me, it was because I was selfish and because I was scared of losing everything I had. Not because I had two sides of me that one person could never fulfill. I broke Celia's heart because I spent half my time loving her and the other half hiding how much I loved her. Never once did I cheat on Celia. If we're defining cheating by desiring another person and then making love to that person, I never once did that. When I was with Celia, I was with Celia. The same way any woman married to a man is with that man. Did I look at other people? Sure. Just like anyone in a relationship does. But I loved Celia. And I shared my true self only with Celia. The problem was, I used my body to get other things I wanted. And I didn't stop doing that even for her. That's my tragedy. That I used my body when it was all I had, and then I kept using it even when I had other options. I kept using it even when I knew it would hurt the woman I loved. And what's more, I made her complicit in it. I put her in a position to continually have to approve of my choices at her own expense. Celia may have left me in a huff, but it was a death by a thousand cuts. I hurt her with these tiny scratches day after day, and then I got surprised when it left a wound too big to heal. I slept with Mick because I wanted to protect our careers, mine and hers, and that was more important to me than the sanctity of our relationship. And I slept with Harry because I wanted a baby and I thought people would get suspicious if we adopted. Because I was afraid to draw attention to the sexlessness of our marriage. And I chose that over the sanctity of our relationship. And when Max Girard had a good idea about a creative choice in a movie, I wanted to do it. And I was willing to do it at the expense of the sanctity of our relationship. You're hard on yourself, I think, I say. Celia wasn't perfect. She could be cruel. Evelyn shrugs slightly. She always made sure the bad was outweighed by so much good. Well, I didn't do that for her. I made it 50-50, which is about the cruelest thing you can do to someone you love. Give them just enough good to make them stick through a hell of a lot of bad. Of course, I realized all this when she left me, and I tried to fix it, but it was too late. As she said, she simply couldn't do it anymore, because it took me too long to figure out what I cared about, not because of my sexuality. I feel confident you're going to get that right. I promise, I say. I will. I know you will. And while we're on the subject of how I'd like to be portrayed, there's something else you need to get exactly right. I won't be able to clear things up after I'm gone. I want to know now. I want to be absolutely sure that you will represent what I'm telling you accurately. Okay, I say. What is it? Evelyn's mood turns a bit darker. I'm not a good person, Monique. Make sure in the book that that's clear. That I'm not claiming to be good. That I did a lot of things that hurt a lot of people. And I would do them over again if I had to. I don't know, I say. You don't seem so bad, Evelyn. You, of all people, are going to change your mind about that, she says. Very soon. And all I can think is, what the fuck did she do?
John died of a heart attack in 1980. He was just shy of 50. It didn't make any sense. The most athletic and fit of us, the one who didn't smoke, the one who exercised every day, he shouldn't have been the one whose heart stopped.
but things don't make sense. And when he left us, he left a giant-sized hole in our lives. Connor was 5. It was hard to explain to her where Uncle John went. It was even harder to explain to her why her father was so heartbroken. For weeks, Harry could barely get out of bed. When he did, it was to drink bourbon. He was rarely sober, always somber, and often unkind. Celia was photographed in tears, her eyes bloodshot, walking into her trailer on location in Arizona. I wanted to hold her. I wanted us all to see one another through it. But I knew that wasn't in the cards. But I could help Harry. So Connor and I stayed with him at his apartment every day. She slept in her room there. I slept on the sofa in his bedroom. I made sure he ate. I made sure he bathed. I made sure he played make-believe with his daughter. One morning I woke up to find Harry and Connor both in the kitchen. Connor was pouring herself a bowl of cereal while Harry stood in his pajama bottoms looking out the window. He had an empty glass in his hand. When he turned away from the view and back toward Connor, I said, "Good morning." And Connor said, "Daddy, why do your eyes look wet?" I wasn't sure if he'd been crying or if he was already a few drinks into the day that early in the morning. At the funeral, I wore a black vintage Halston. Harry wore a black suit with a black shirt, black tie, black belt, and black socks. Grief never left his face. His profound, guttural pain didn't follow the story we had sold the press, that Harry and John were friends, that Harry and I were in love. Nor did the fact that John left the house to Harry. But despite my instincts, I did not encourage Harry to hide his feelings or decline the house. I had very little energy left to try to hide who we were. I had learned all too well that pain was sometimes stronger than the need to keep up appearances. Celia was there, in a long-sleeved black mini-dress. She did not say hello to me. She barely looked at me. I stared at her, aching to walk over and grab her hand, but I didn't take a single step in her direction. I was not going to use this loss of Harry's to ease my own. I wasn't going to make her talk to me, not like that. Harry held back tears as John's casket was lowered into the ground. Celia walked away. Connor watched me watch her and said, "Mom, who is that lady? I think I know her." "You do, honey," I said. "You did." And then Connor, my adorable baby girl, said, "She's the one who dies in your movie." And I realized she didn't remember Celia at all. She recognized her from Little Women. "She's the nice one, the one who wants everyone to be happy," Connor said. That's when I knew the family I had made had truly disintegrated.
Now this. July 3rd, 1980. Celia St. James and Joan Marker, best of friends. Celia St. James and Hollywood newcomer Joan Marker have become the talk of the town lately. Marker, best known for her star-making turn in last year's Promise Me, is quickly becoming the it girl of the season, and who better to show her the ropes than America's sweetheart? Seen shopping together in Santa Monica and grabbing lunches in Beverly Hills, the two can't seem to get enough of each other. We certainly hope this means the duo are planning a movie together, because that would be a tour de force of performances.
I knew the only way to get Harry to start living his life again was to surround him with Connor and work. The Connor part was easy. She loved her father. She wanted his attention every second of the day. She was growing up to look even more like him, with his ice-blue eyes and his broad, tall frame. And when he was with her, he would stop drinking. He cared about being a good father, and he knew he had a responsibility to be sober for her. But when he went back to his own home every night, a fact still secret from the outside world, I knew he was drinking himself to sleep. On the days he was not with us, I knew he wasn't getting out of bed. So work was my only option. I had to find something he would love. It had to be a script he would feel passionate about and one with a great role for me. Not just because I wanted a great role, but also because Harry wouldn't do anything for himself, but he would do anything if he believed I needed him to. So I read scripts. Hundreds of scripts over the months. And then Max Girard sent me one that he was having trouble getting made. It was called All for Us. It was about a single mother of three who moves to New York City to try to support her children and pursue her dreams. It was about trying to make ends meet in the cold, hard city, but it was also about hope and daring to believe you deserve more, both of which I knew would appeal to Harry. And the role of Renee, the mother, was honest, righteous, and powerful. I ran it over to Harry and begged him to read it. When he tried to avoid it, I said, I think it will finally get me my Oscar. That's what made him pick it up. I loved shooting All for Us. And it wasn't because I finally got that goddamn statue for it, or because I became even closer with Max Girard on the set. I loved shooting All for Us because while it didn't get Harry to put down the bottle, it did get him out of bed. 4 months after the movie came out, Harry and I went to the Oscars together. Max Girard had attended with a model named Bridget Manners, but he had joked for weeks before the event that all he wanted was to attend with me, to have me on his arm. He had even taken to joking that given all the men I'd married, he was crushed that I'd never married him. I had to admit that Max was quickly becoming someone I truly felt close to. So while he did technically have a date, it felt, as we all sat in the first row together, that I was there with the two men who meant the most to me. Connor was back at the hotel, watching on TV with Louisa. Earlier that day, she had given Harry and me each a picture she had drawn. Mine was a gold star. Harry's was a lightning bolt. She said they were for luck. I tucked mine into my clutch. Harry put his in his tuxedo pocket. When they called out the nominees for Best Actress, I realized that I hadn't really ever believed I could win. With the Oscar would come certain things I'd always wanted. Credibility. Gravitas. And if I truly looked inward, I realized I didn't think I had credibility or gravitas. Harry squeezed my hand as Brick Thomas opened the envelope. And then, despite everything I had told myself, he said my name. I stared straight ahead, my chest heaving, unable to process what I'd heard. And then Harry looked at me and said, "You did it." I stood up and hugged him. I walked to the podium. I took the Oscar that Brick was handing me, and I put my hand to my chest to try to slow down my heartbeat. When the clapping subsided, I leaned into the microphone and gave a speech that was both premeditated and extemporaneous. I tried to remember what I'd prepared to say all the other times I thought I might win. "Thank you," I said, looking out into a sea of familiar, gorgeous faces. "Thank you not just for this award, which I will cherish forever, but also for letting me work in this business. It hasn't always been easy, and God knows I've made a bumpy road of it. But I feel so incredibly lucky to live this life. So thank you not just to every producer I've worked with since the mid-50s, oh God, I'm really dating myself here, but specifically to my favorite producer, Harry Cameron. I love you. I love our child. Hi, Connor. Go to sleep now, honey. It's getting late. And to all the other actors and actresses I've worked with, to all the directors who have helped me grow as a performer, especially Max Girard. I thank you. By the way, I believe this counts as a hat trick, Max. And there's one other person out there whom I think of every day."
10 years before, I would have been far too scared to say anything more. I probably would have been too scared even to say that. But I had to tell her. Even though I hadn't spoken to her in years, I had to show her that I still loved her, that I always would. I know she's watching right now, and I just hope she knows how important she is to me. Thank you all. Thank you. Shaking, I walked backstage and got hold of myself. I talked to reporters, I accepted congratulations, and I got back to my seat just in time for Max to win Best Director and Harry to win Best Picture. Afterward, the three of us posed for photo after photo, grinning from ear to ear. We had climbed to the very top of the mountain, and that night we stuck our flags into the summit. Sometime around 1 in the morning, after Harry had already gone back to the hotel to check on Connor, Max and I were outside in the courtyard of a mansion owned by the head of Paramount. There was a circular fountain spraying water into the night sky. Max and I sat, marveling at what we had accomplished together. His limo pulled up. "Can I give you a ride back to your hotel?" he asked. "Where's your date?" Max shrugged. I fear she was only interested in the ticket to the show. I laughed. Poor Max. "Not poor Max," he said, shaking his head. "I spent my evening with the most beautiful woman in the world." I shook my head. "You are too much." "You look hungry. Come, get in the car. We will get hamburgers." "Hamburgers?" "I'm sure even Evelyn Hugo eats a hamburger from time to time." Max opened the limo door and waited for me to get in. "Your chariot," he said. I wanted to go home and see Connor. I wanted to watch the way her mouth hung open as she slept. But the idea of getting a hamburger with Max Girard actually didn't sound so bad. Minutes later, the limo driver was trying to navigate the drive-through of a Jack-in-the-Box, and Max and I decided it was easier to get out of the car and go in. The two of us stood in line, me in my navy blue silk gown, him in his tux, behind two teenage boys ordering French fries. And then when we got to the front of the line, the cashier screamed as if she'd seen a mouse. "Oh my God," she said, "you're Evelyn Hugo." I laughed. "I have no idea what you're talking about," I said. After 25 years, that line still worked every time. "You're her, Evelyn Hugo." "Nonsense. This is the greatest day of my life," she said. And then she called to the back, "Norm, you have to come see this. Evelyn Hugo is here, in a gown." Max laughed as more and more people started to stare. I was beginning to feel like a caged animal. It's not something you really ever get used to, being stared at in small spaces. A few of the people in the kitchen came forward to look at me. "Any chance we could get 2 burgers? Max said. "Extra cheese on 9, please." Everyone ignored him. "Can I have your autograph?" the woman behind the counter asked. "Sure," I said kindly. I was hoping it would be over soon, that we could get the food and go. I started signing paper menus and paper hats. I signed a couple of receipts. "We really should be going," I said. "It's late." But no one stopped. They all just kept pushing things at me. "You won an Oscar," an older woman said, "just a few hours ago." "I saw it. I saw it myself." "I did, yes," I said. I pointed at Max with the pen in my hand. "So did he." Max waved. I signed a few more things, shook a few more hands. "Okay, I really must be going," I said. But the mob of people crowded me more. "Okay," Max said, "let the lady breathe." I looked in the direction of his voice and saw him coming toward me, breaking up the crowd. He handed me the burgers, picked me up, threw me over his shoulder, and walked us right out of the restaurant and into the limo. "Wow," I said when he put me down. He got in next to me. He grabbed the bag. "Evelyn,
he said. What? I love you. What do you mean you love me? He leaned over, smooshed the burgers, and kissed me. It felt as